Okay, so welcome to our second session on the Ambata Sutta, DN3. And we'd like to start, as we often do in these classes, with a chance for any questions from you about the previous one or about the sutta in general. Anything on your mind as we get going today?
Do you want to give a little review about what we did yesterday, Kim?
Yeah. So we talked yesterday about, or say yesterday, but of course it was Monday, about the storytelling nature of the Digha Nikaya Suttas, is that many of them are long, the long discourses, and they're long because they have these kind of elaborate stories. The stories are often set up that way as these narratives, usually of the questioner talking with the Buddha, as well as some other characters supporting, kind of as conversion narratives. And we'll see more of that as this goes along. It was positioning the Buddha's teachings relative to other teachings at the time. Now, the Buddha didn't arise in a vacuum. And so there was, so we talked about that aspect. And then in our dramatization, we saw something about this character. Mostly we saw the character Ambata being respectful to his teacher, Poparasati, who's a very well-known senior Brahmin. And in that case, he was told to go look for the 32 marks. And so he did. He said, yes, I will. But then when he actually arrived, he remembered the time that the Sakyans insulted him. And so he had a big self come up and was not respectful to the Buddha and his monks. And so we had some tension there because he ended up calling the Sakyans riffraff three times. And that was where we left off. And we'll continue with that today, but we're curious about any, if there's anything coming up.
Maybe I'll say something that's interesting, is that, Kim, you're using this word, this dramatization, but really, we're just reading the sutta, you know, with each of us having characters. So it's fascinating that the sutta itself is providing the script. You'll see, especially today, we kind of like, we're not going to go through every single thing in the sutta, so we cut some pieces out. But it's fascinating that the sutta itself has this drama. And we might consider, like, why is that?
And further, and again, if there are no questions or reflections, I'm just looking around to see if there are any hand raised. Feel free to use the little hand provided by Zoom, but also just raise a hand, wave it around. But I just, sort of building on Diana's point, part of our exploration here for the four of us as teachers is to better understand how the oral culture that preserved these texts so that we can benefit from them had a different character, had a different feeling, that even read in voices somehow, the characters come alive, and our idea is that so too do the teachings. In other words, there's something about this way of interacting with the what are now texts, interacting with them as part of an oral tradition of thousands of years, actually very forcefully frames the teachings, advances the teachings, maybe creates a way for the teachings to enter that's different than when we read a text or hear about it or see it quoted. So, any thoughts? Any questions?
Catherine has her hand up.
Catherine.
When I heard Ambata calling the Buddha's clan and him riffraff, I felt like I could relate. Not that I would want to call the Buddha riffraff, but that I might not know what the appropriate way would be to greet and act with teachers. And since a lot of my interaction has been with the teachers, you teachers, on Zoom, I'm not asking, have I been respectful? But I wonder if there isn't some way that, well, even when I was going to the center, I heard reference to you don't leave the room before the teacher, or you don't speak over the teacher, you know, those two things, but that's not much. And I wonder if today there are rules of respect that I might not know.
It's a good point. And there is a certain kind of culture that's developed in the Insight tradition, at least, and to the point where some centers have kind of guidelines for beginners or something on their websites that include things like remembering to take off your shoes before you go in the meditation hall. Sometimes they mention the Thai tradition of not pointing the feet at the teacher, things like that. And, you know, these are things that wouldn't be known necessarily. And having been involved in developing some of these at certain centers, there's also sometimes a mixed feeling about posting them or somehow communicating them. They simultaneously serve to settle doubts and anxieties, and they can also incite some irritation from people. So it's a balance, and probably you can't ever please anyone, everyone, shall we say. But humans have these protocols, and for the most part, they're useful. Yeah.
And maybe I'll just add, like, it's the usual thing that you would show to anybody who is talking, the usual stuff, not showing up late or not getting up in the middle when somebody's talking or when the teacher's talking and leaving, you know, these kinds of things I would just throw in there.
How about Susan?
Well, I want first to say that this is just delightful. So thank you for putting this together.
Thank you, Susan.
I think the observation that it's different when we're experiencing it orally is true. And it's also different, of course, that it's written in a different style, written as a dialogue, which makes me experience it in various ways. I noticed early on when Amita was disrespectful to the Buddha, I found myself wondering, from the perspective of the Buddha, how will I handle this? And really being curious to see how he would handle it. So it's a whole different dimension because it's a dialogue. And because it's slowed down, I guess, by being oral instead of reading, I just get dashed through and see how he handled it. So it's cool. Thank you for putting it on.
Yeah. It does give that flavor. Great. Yeah. And they are dialogues. You know, for the most part, the Buddha taught through dialogue. With somebody asking a question, and the context often matters. And so we're getting a lot more of that in these story-like ones. All right, so with that, I'll pass it on to Diana.
Okay, so I'm going to do a little bit of a meditation, and maybe this is for the four of us, for us to feel a little bit calm before we about to embark on this. But also just an opportunity for us to kind of like finish arriving, so to speak, to arrive into this space. So, and what we're about to do together. So we'll begin by just taking a meditative posture, one that has some alertness, some uprightness, and has some ease and relaxation. And then checking in with the body. How is the body at this moment? That might mean noticing the pressure against the body where we're sitting, pressure of the chair, the cushion, the couch, wherever we might be. Noticing the body in the sense of to sit and know that you're sitting, checking in if there's some places that have some obvious tension or tightness or uncomfortableness. Can we invite that into our meditation too? Even though it might not be what we wish for, it is here. So with a sense of acceptance, openness, can we allow the present moment experience to be as it is? And of course, the body is breathing. Can we tune into that experience? The movement of the chest or the belly. The stretching. And the return of the stretch as the body breathes. And with that same attitude of allowing, just noticing that when the mind wanders, this is what minds do, you just very gently bring the mind back. Begin again with the sensations of breathing. We don't have to make a big story, just very simply begin again. Allowing the rhythm of the sensations of breathing to be a support for a softening, letting go, tuning in to this moment. It is sometimes said that we are in the information age. So much information readily available. Can you imagine what it might be like if the only source, the single source of information, is what somebody has told you? What you have heard from others is the only way you would learn anything, know about anything, confirm anything, is only about dialogue. No reading, no writing, no recording of any sort. What people say is of paramount importance. Can you imagine? And then coming back from that imagination to feeling grounded, connected to this experience.
Thank you, Diana, for this settling sit. And I wonder, maybe just to follow along what Diana said towards the end, this oral tradition where, you know, there is no texting and messaging and emails and social media and what have you. And so in that backdrop, as a background, you can see the words, how they are said, what words are chosen to be said, can carry a lot of, I don't say fire in them, right? So in our next reading, I want to just tee up a little bit that there are some challenges in this reading I want to point out, maybe just to orient our mind and heart a little bit. This next piece of reading, the different translations use the words that can be challenging, triggering for many people, especially given the modern day context that we are living in here in America, right? And so I just say a few of those, a slave, slave girl, and the Pali term is Disa, black boy, and that's Sujato's translation. The Pali term Kangha, goblins, you know, Will texting the text message, goblins. It's the Pali term of Pisaka. And, well, you know, even when the teaching team looked into different translations, we were all kind of like, and so we wanted to just acknowledge this, and the teaching team recognized the potential difficulties because of the context we're in, the associations we may attribute to them. And so in our reading, we actually came up with something that we felt to be more true to what is expressed, and that is not necessarily Sujato's translation or other people's translations. Doesn't mean that these are better translations, but it's really just really offer some care in terms of these words that are being used. They are rather significant in this piece of a teaching that is unfolding as well. So we did spend quite a lot of time in working with this challenge as part of the teaching team. I also want to acknowledge that this is not necessarily just a translation issue. They are challenging issues at the time, and they are challenging issues now where we are, right? And so as a teaching team, we also felt like simply avoiding it, kind of bypassing this piece of a conversation, you know. So as we practice, as part of our practice and learning, maybe what is needed is to offer respectful recognition of this, and a learning and a striving to skillfully relate to this piece of a text and see what the teaching is conveying here. So then maybe that's the invitation that I will offer as we listen to this, or watch and listen to this next piece of a dramatic reading, which started after Ambata called the Buddha riffraff and the whole Sakyans riffraffs three times. So here we go. This next tea piece.
This Ambata puts down the Sakyans too much by calling them riffraff. Ambata, what is your clan?
I am a Kanhanyan, Master Gautama.
Ambata, in former days, according to those who remember the ancestral lineage, the Sakyans were the masters, and you are descended from a slave girl of the Sakyans. The Sakyans regard King Okaka as their ancestor. King Okaka had a slave girl named Disa, and she gave birth to a black baby named Kanha. When he was born, the black baby Kanha said, "Wash me, mother, bathe me, get this filth off of me. I will be useful to you." Whereas these days, when people see goblins, they call them goblins. In those days, they called goblins black kanha. The Sakin said, he spoke as soon as he was born. From that day on, the Kanhayanas were recognized, and he was their founder. That's how, in former days, according to those who remember the ancestral lineage, the Sakins were the masters, and you are descended from a slave girl of the Sakins.
Master Gotama, please don't put Ambata down too much by calling him the son of a slave girl. He's well born, he's a gentleman, learned, a good speaker, astute. He's capable of having a dialogue with Master Gotama about this.
Well, students, if you think that Ambata is ill-born, not a gentleman, uneducated, a poor speaker, witless, and not capable of having a dialogue with me about this, then leave him aside and you can have a dialogue with me. But if you think he is well-born, a gentleman, learned, a good speaker, astute, and capable of having a dialogue with me about this, then you should stand aside and let him have a dialogue with me.
Ambata is capable of having a dialogue with you. I'll be silent and let Ambata have a dialogue with Master Gotama.
Well, Ambata, there's a legitimate question that comes up. You won't like it, but you ought to answer it anyway. If you don't answer, but dodge the issue, remain silent, or simply leave, your head will explode in 7 pieces right here. What do you think, Ambata? According to what you have heard from elderly and senior Brahmins, what is the origin of the Kanhayanas and who is their founder?
When he had said this, Ambata kept silent. And so for a second time, the Buddha put the question to Ambata, and for a second time, Ambata kept silent.
Answer now, Ambata. Now is not the time for silence. If someone fails to answer a legitimate question when asked 3 times by the Buddha, their head explodes into 7 pieces there and then.
Now, at this time, the spirit Vajrapani, holding a massive iron spear, burning and blazing and glowing, stood in the sky above Ambata, thinking, if this Ambata doesn't answer this question a third time, I'll blow his head into 7 pieces here and now. And both the Buddha and Ambata could see Vajrapani. Ambata was terrified, shocked, awestruck. Looking to the Buddha for shelter, protection, and refuge, Ambata sat down close to the Buddha.
What did you say? Please repeat the question.
What do you think, Ambata? According to what you have heard from elderly and senior Brahmins, what is the origin of the Kanhayanas and who is their founder?
I have heard, Master Gotama, that it is just as you say, that is the origin of the Kanhayanas, and that's who their founder is.
It turns out that Ambata is ill-born, not a gentleman, descended from a Sakyan slave, and the Sakyans are Ambata's masters. We disparaged the recluse, Gotama, thinking he was not speaking the truth.
These students put Ambata down too much by calling him the son of a slave. Why don't I get him out of this? Students, please don't put Ambata down too much by calling him the son of a slave. That Kanha was an eminent sage. That Kanha was an eminent sage who later married the king's daughter. What do you think, Ambata? Suppose the Brahmins, for some reason, were to shave a Brahmin's head, inflict him with a sack of ashes, and banish him from the city. Would he receive a seat and water from the Brahmins?
No, that banished Brahmin would not receive a seat from the other Brahmins, Master Gotama.
And would the Brahmins feed him at an offering of food for ancestors, a sacrifice, or a feast for guests?
No, those Brahmins would not feed the banished Brahmin.
And would the Brahmins teach him the sacred verses or not?
No, the other Brahmins would not teach that banished Brahmin the sacred verses.
And what do you think, Ambata? Suppose the aristocrats were for some reason to shave an aristocrat's head and inflict him with a sack of ashes and banish him from the nation or the city. Would he receive a seat and water from the Brahmins?
Yes, the banished aristocrat would receive a seat from the Brahmins, Master Gotama.
And would the Brahmins feed him at an offering of food for ancestors, a sacrifice, or a feast for guests?
Yes, the Brahmins would feed that banished aristocrat.
And would the Brahmins teach him the sacred verses or not?
Yes, the Brahmins would teach the banished aristocrat the sacred verses.
Aha, so at this point, Ambata, that aristocrat has reached rock bottom, with head shaven, inflicted with a set of ashes, and banished from the city or nation. Yet still, the aristocrats are superior and the Brahmins inferior. Brahma Sanankumara spoke this verse. The aristocrat is first among people who take clan as the standard. But one accomplished in knowledge and conduct is first among gods and humans. Now that verse was well said by the Brahma Sanankumara, not poorly said, well spoken, not poorly spoken, beneficial, not harmful, and it was approved by me. For I also say, the aristocrat is first among people who take clan as the standard. But one accomplished in knowledge and conduct is first among gods and humans.
But what, Master Gotama, is that conduct? And what is that knowledge?
Ambata, in the supreme knowledge and conduct, there is no discussion of ancestry or clan or pride. Whoever is attached to questions of ancestry or clan or pride is far from the supreme knowledge and conduct. The realization of supreme knowledge and conduct occurs when you've given up such things.
So that ended this long zigzag conversation between Ambata and the Buddha. I want to offer a few reflection words on this piece. As you can see, you know, after hearing this kind of back and forth between the two, one thing that occurred to me was that this pedagogical teaching kind of style or device that contrast and highlight the teaching of the true Brahman that the Buddha read in the end. The Buddha, or Kim read in the end. The Buddha conveyed in the end. But it didn't just happen. You know, it was after a long back and forth between Ambata and the Buddha. And partly because Ambata showed up with a certain kind of attitude and that he just wasn't ready. And so the Buddha had to do kind of preparation work by speaking in the terrain that Ambata understands, using his language, using what his mind is associated with, before this last piece of a teaching is conveyed. So I wanted to just share this one slide to maybe highlight a little bit. of this back and forth that was happening. So let's see. Okay. So in this back and forth, let's see if it's loading here. Ambata showed up full of himself and started calling riffraffs to the Buddha. And then in this conversation between Ambata and the Buddha first had to settle a little bit of that full of himself by using his knowledge of Ambata's clan, the lineage, and pointing out that you are coming from the son of a slave girl, and kind of a putting in his mindset that, oh, your lineage actually has something that isn't said. And he pointed this out in order to kind of temper down a little bit of Ambata's mind. But what happened in this drama is when this was said, the Brahmin student made an uproar, kind of like, what? This can't be true. But it was true. Vajrapani, a little spirit, came up, right? And so that actually pushed Ambata to this totally miserable kind of a domain. And the Buddha had to reestablish his state of being a little bit by pointing out, well, it's not all like that. And here, Ambata also has a heritage of being a sage, has a certain qualities that worthy of respect. But then towards the end, after all this drama and settling Ambata's mind, the Buddha now had to establish himself in this social setting that Ambata is Ambata cared about, by pointing out that aristocrats are actually higher than all that you cared about. And there is this interesting debate that we're going back and forth that the Buddha was, including partially because the Brahmins are also trained in this form of analysis. So Buddha was still using the kind of a style that Ambata was familiar with. But then, in the end, the Buddha quoted the Brahman, a Brahma quote, in order to establish the true Brahman teaching, which is based on knowledge and conduct, based on the inner quality, rather than all this social constructs and external qualities. So you can see, there's a teaching style that pedagogical style that the Buddha used, so much has to do with establishing that connection with the audience in such a way that they can connect with what the Buddha had to say. And then in the end, the teaching kind of in a sleight of hand was offered, conveyed. So maybe that's a little visual that I'll offer. And then I'll just say a few words about the little piece that showed up in this exchange is this spirit of Vajrapani. and the spirit that only the Buddha and Ambata saw. And the context of this this spirit that showed up was that the Buddha asked the Ambata questions three times. In this tradition, usually the three times of a questioning is quite significant. And so we see that. But exactly how do we relate to the presence of Vajrapani, of the spirit? Do we take the presence as literally, or do we believe that this is simply not true because this is just a drama that got inserted? I invite maybe for some creative way of relating to this. For me personally, you know, instead of completely believing it's true or dismissing it, I wondered about whether there are some ways that we can relate to this that could be interesting and supportive. For example, for me, some of this kind of a mystical dimensions coming in the sutta also evoke a sense of heart quality. And maybe people who are composing, reciting this pieces have some deep love and devotion to the Buddha and his qualities. And we don't quite know. And as I was reading some of these pieces, the don't know mind comes in. You know, we don't have to know. But maybe it has some space in our heart, in our mind, that offers something that's supportive. And sometimes, maybe other times it may not. And so I want to just invite some creative association with things like this in the suttas. So with that, I'm going to pass on to David.
Thank you, Ying. Thanks for being Vajrapani too, with the the sword and flames, fairy and mask. Yeah, great. Yeah, so we'd like to just open it up now before proceeding to a next reading to just see if there are any questions or reflections on this comment. We've got time for just a couple questions or reflections if anybody has anything to share. Jerry.
I have a reflection and sort of a question. Maybe I'll just do the question.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm learning slowly. I've always suspected, but this is the first time in my hearing, so this is the question. Buddha was, because I think all religious leaders are sort of revolutionaries to their culture, liberators. But this, to me, we studied it before, but it seems like this sutta could be taken, and I'm asking, very much as a real indictment, or at least a thinking exercise regarding the caste system. And I see now for the first time, he uses their logic and then turns it around of this is really what's important. So is this known as revealing the Buddha's true, deeper position on caste?
It's a great question, Jerry, and it runs through here. And I think, the simple pat answer would be yes, or yes, perhaps. And it may be more complicated than that. It's not just caste, right? It's anything that has to do with things that we attach to, that we become attached to as self. So it's caste and more. So the revolution maybe goes deeper than just sort of a so that runs through the teachings. But yes, you point to something quite interesting, and I would just say there's a really wonderful Aikido here where the Buddha establishes in this, using the rhetorical devices of Brahmins, establishes that he actually comes from a pure lineage. And then he says, that's not important. So it's a 1-2 punch and more. That's Steve.
Sorry, I don't think it was mentioned in your commentary, but in that last piece, the Buddha, before the final teaching, the Buddha says that the Kshatriyas, the aristocrats are Kshatriyas, right? Isn't that right? Yes. So are of higher respect than the Brahmins. But Ying, I think you said, that establishes the Buddha, gives context to where the Buddha's coming from. And you didn't mention that the Buddha is a member of that class. But that is true, right?
Yeah. That's right. A really important point. Thanks.
That's absolutely right. And also say, thank you for pointing that out. In fact, it's the Brahma who says that, because the Buddha quoted the Brahma. So that credibility, you know, you can see this Aikido, right, move that kind of like put this words back to the Brahmas, the Brahmins realm. But they said that the Buddha, Buddha's clan is the highest.
So it was even a more sensitive teaching, because he gave himself the authority, and then he demolished even his own authority in the worldly sense.
Yes.
And we have time for one more. Will, I see your hand up.
The Brahmin that the Buddha quoted, is he one of the ancient rishis to whom the Vedas were attributed, or is he another Brahmin?
Good question. I'm going to let Diana field that.
Yeah, he's higher than a rishi. He's a Brahma, which means he's like one of the creator gods higher gods, something like that. So the absolute highest authority in the Brahmanical tradition.
Thanks for that question, Will. That helps establish him and the previous question, the Buddha, kind of in a broader context.
And I'd like to just mention one small thing here that's kind of implicit, but maybe it's helpful to make it explicit. By the Buddha saying, you know, actually, Ambata, you know, your ancestral lineage is not exactly like you've been saying it is, he's kind of saying that Ambata and his family are not telling the truth. Have not been telling the truth. And this has so much implications, right? When everything depends on what people say, to kind of like undermine Ambata in this way is really a big thing. It's a really big thing. So I'll just. Yeah.
And we'll get to it in a moment, but I would just, following Diana's comment, the gentleness with which the Buddha does this makes it quite difficult to see. Because of the many ways that one could move this direction, the Buddha is very careful in his approach. We'll talk about that in a moment. So now we'd like to move to another reading, which I'll set up briefly with just a couple comments, and then I'll put on the narrator Ananda's hat, and we'll move back into a reading. But as we've just said, by invoking Brahma and then reaffirming it with his own voice, the Buddha forcefully reframes the debate for Ambata and for all present and for us, revealing what's really important in the spiritual practice, what makes a true Brahman or a true holy person or true follower of a spiritual path, knowledge and conduct, or something he calls knowledge and conduct. So it's interesting that here Ambata starts to seem curious in a way that he wasn't at the outset. And he seems to open up a bit, and he asks the Buddha to elaborate. It's the first time he's asked sort of a question of the Buddha of this sort. What do you mean by this knowledge and conduct? Tell me more. Now I'm interested. Whatever the Buddha's done in his approach, it seems to have landed a bit with Ambata in this kind of opening of the mind to something that wasn't previously interested in. And with that, there's a little bit of dropping the self. Some of that pride and prejudice has been softened. So in the reading that follows, the Buddha does tell him something, Ambata, something about this knowledge and conduct in the form of something called the gradual training. Without putting in a plug for the four of us, we did a whole course on the gradual training a few years ago. And it's important to notice that we did a whole course. It's very detailed in some of the other suttas. Here, it's abbreviated. And yet, the implication is that the audience would have known about, unlike Ambata, they would have known about the gradual training. And so it can be just mentioned. And so you'll hear little corners of the development of ethical action, sila, samadhi, the cultivation of a meditated centeredness and collectedness of mind, and panya, seeing clearly, the wisdom that comes, the insight that comes from our practice. They're mentioned briefly here, but the implication is that a longer description was actually involved. So I'm now donning the hat of the narrator. If I'm really quick about this, I can change my name to narrator and slip back into the action. So we join Ambata and the Buddha after the Buddha has again reframed the argument with this passage. In the supreme knowledge and conduct, he tells Ambata, there is no discussion of ancestry or clan. Now we're into something new. Ancestry or clan or pride have no place in the realization of the supreme knowledge and conduct.
But what, Master Gautama, is that conduct, and what is that knowledge?
Ambata, it's when a realized one arises in the world, perfected, a fully awakened Buddha, accomplished in knowledge and conduct, holy, knower of the world, supreme guide for those who wish to train, teacher of gods and humans, awakened, blessed. He teaches Dhamma that's good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And he reveals a spiritual practice that's entirely full and pure. A householder hears that teaching, or a householder's child, or someone born in some clan. They gain faith in the realized one and go forth in the monastic sangha. Having trained in ethical conduct, sense restraint, and mindfulness, they resort to a secluded place, arouse compassion for all living beings, and meditate. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unskillful qualities, they enter and remain in the first jhana. This pertains to their conduct. Further, they enter and remain in the second, third, and fourth jhana. This too pertains to their conduct. This is that conduct. When their mind has become immersed in samadhi like this, purified, bright, flawless, rid of corruptions, pliable, workable, steady, and imperturbable, they extend it and project it toward knowledge and vision. This pertains to their knowledge. They understand there is no return to any state of existence. This too pertains to their knowledge. This is that knowledge. This mendicant is said to be accomplished in knowledge and also accomplished in conduct and also accomplished in knowledge and conduct. And Ambata, there is no accomplishment in knowledge and conduct better or finer than this.
Having said this, the Buddha came out of his dwelling and proceeded to begin walking mindfully. And Ambata did likewise. While walking beside the Buddha, Ambata scrutinized his body for the 32 marks of a great man. He saw all of them except for two, which he had doubts about, whether the private parts were covered in a sheath and the largeness of the tongue. And the Buddha, knowing this, used his psychic power to will that Ambata could see his private parts covered in a sheath. And he stuck out his tongue and stroked back and forth on his ear holes and nostrils, covering his entire forehead with his tongue.
The recluse Gautama possesses the 32 marks completely, lacking none. Well, now, sir, I must go. I have many duties and much to do.
Please, Ambata, go at your convenience.
So, I got to take my hat off. I'm back to David. This is a short but quite important passage that sets up the denouement, the climax of the action that comes Friday. The Buddha's expertly constructed set of rhetorical devices, drawn from the Brahmin's own tradition of formal debate, has allowed him to turn the tables and make Ambatta, and we can sense maybe the whole audience a little bit more receptive to his teachings, even though Ambatta was clearly checking her watch and, not entirely tuned in. There's a greater receptivity of the teaching. It's really fascinating that the Buddha perceives Ambatta's pride and prejudice not as an impediment, but as a vehicle for offering a shift of perspective. The Buddha's whole focus is on the teaching, and in Ambatta's views, he sees a bigger picture, right? He sees clinging, selfing, suffering, and the way to freedom. How did this transformation happen? We might suggest that part of it has to do with wise speech. We can perceive throughout, wonderfully portrayed by Kim in the role of the Buddha, the Buddha's use of wise speech. There's no anger, offense taken, vindictiveness, or hostility in the Buddha's speech. His speech, we can sense, comes from an open heart, has an eye on freedom. It's truthful, and it's spoken at the right time, the marks of wise speech. Keeps his eye on the big picture, the opportunity in this setting, any set of conditions to teach and to open minds to the teachings. So he lays out this gradual training, the path toward the knowledge and conduct that makes for a true Brahmin. And importantly, as came up in the question just a moment ago, is open to anybody, regardless of birth, caste, class, or religious tradition. Interesting and really important, given what comes up on Friday, is that the Buddha describes the gradual training to Ambatta. He doesn't actually lead him through it, and he doesn't lead him to the final teaching of the gradual path. The Buddha seems to discern that even though there's some softening and opening, he can tell from the Buddha, the Ambatta's checking of the watch and looking around bored, that Ambatta's mind isn't fully prepared. It's not ready. There's some opening. We can wish Ambatta well, perhaps. Maybe he's on a path to greater openness, but his mind is not fully ready. Although his mind isn't fully ready, we can see at the end of the passage that Ambatta can perceive that the Buddha is an enlightened being. Although it's only after he's been thoroughly thrashed in the debate and received a description of the knowledge and conduct, he does do what his teacher asked him to do first. He looks for the 32 marks. Too late, turns out. He could have checked them earlier. He would have known the Buddha as a great being, a great man, an enlightened person in this case. But we wouldn't have had much of a story. It's interesting, pointed out the other day by Diana as we talked, just that here we see Ambatta walking mindfully alongside the Buddha. The Buddha emerges from his dwelling, walks mindfully, and Ambatta joins him. So here again, there's a sign that although his mind isn't fully prepared for the teachings, he's now open to the Buddha in a way that he wasn't previously, and he's treating him with respect, which is a big change. Again, it's not enough. He's not ready. And yet, there's some movement in the direction of freedom. Ambatta now departs to report back to his teacher, and we'll pick up that action on Friday. I think, though, we can have a feeling that he's in for a scolding, not having followed his teacher's instructions and having made something of a fool of himself in the presence of an enlightened being. Diana.
Thank you, David. So now I'd like to open it up for you guys to have a chance to talk amongst yourselves a little bit about what you've seen so far. And we might say that one of the key developments at this point in the story is that Ambatta was first, so concerned about who respects who and what is the protocol and etiquette and clan and ancestral lineage. And then we have this shift to a concern about knowledge and conduct. And even Ambatta asks, well, what is that knowledge and conduct? Even if he doesn't really hear the Buddha's answers, at least he asked about it. So we have this shift from Ambatta being about clan and pride and then to, well, what is knowledge and conduct? So maybe this is something we can all relate to. that initially we might come to these teachings with some idea of what we want, what's important, and what is the most important. And then as we practice, maybe there's a shift. As we've been exposed, we might even say, to the Buddhist teachings, there's a shift to something else that seems more important. Or maybe what we thought was the most important starts to become less important. So we'd like to put you into some breakout groups. There'll be like three or four of you in a group, and you'll be there for about 12 minutes. And that is to talk about, have you had a shift where what you've been concerned about or considered most important, then through practice, you realize, maybe that isn't as important. For example, maybe like working with a particular personal suffering, and then maybe you could see things a little bit bigger, more people than just about yourself. I just offer that as an example. And it's helpful when you're in these small groups to not say everything you know about this topic or to tell your deepest, darkest secrets. There's 12 minutes and there's three or four of you. So maybe just make one point and allow it to go to the next person. They make one point, goes to the next person. They make one point, goes to the next person. They make one point. So in this way, everybody has an opportunity to speak and maybe an opportunity to learn and share from others. Often, sometimes the extroverts will want to go first, right? That's natural, of course, almost the definition of extroverts. So in order to kind of make sure that the introverts get in there too, why don't we go in alphabetical order within the groups? Okay, so with that setting it up, here we go.
Oh, I'm happy. Steve had predicted what's going to happen next. Great, great. Yeah, so welcome back. And this is a period where we can do a debrief or Q&A or share. And I also want to invite for those who wanted to put some comments in the chat box to see, you know, how you're feeling about this way of teaching or this way of reading and studying sutta, and or, you know, any other comments that may be jumping out. So feel free to use the chat box. Okay, so Steve.
Well, I had a question, Diana, about the, I'll use the word theatrics, which were very convincing. And I wondered if they seemed extreme to me, and I wondered if that's, if would Ambatta have taken that very intimate, mindful walk with the Buddha? It seemed to me that was a very significant thing, the two of them walking together mindfully. This seemed very intimate somehow to me. And would he have done that had he been truly as eye-rolling as you portrayed him? That's my question.
Yeah, I think this is a legitimate question, right? But we can, for me, I'm struck by the Buddha gives this like incredible teaching, and all Ambatta cares about is whether he has the 32 marks. That Ambatta doesn't even acknowledge that the Buddha gave this. He just wants to see if he has the 32 marks. So we could say he's walking mindfully with the Buddha because he wants to see if he has the 32 marks. That one of the marks is how he walks, you know. So I don't know, and I was exaggerating this, right? But then I wanted to convey the point that it just bounced right off of Ambatta. He wasn't taking it in. So,
yeah, thank you. And Wing.
I'm wondering if you can, somebody that knows is more scholarly than me, what are these, where does these 32 marks come from? Is it part of, and, you know, I know a lot of this wasn't written down for, you know, many, many, many years after the life of the Buddha. Is this part of the culture of the time, or is it like a poetry, or is it what do these marks signify? Like the thing about the ankles looking like something, where did that come from, and what part of the culture does that come from?
Maybe I'll say a few words. So the Buddhists point to the Brahmins and say it's only ever Brahmins who ask about it, who are concerned about it. And the Buddha obliges them sometimes by showing those two marks that aren't readily seen. But a Buddhist or a wanderer never asks about them. But so that's kind of like the assumption that the Buddha, just like we've seen him earlier in this, is meeting Ambatta where he is and knows that Ambatta is concerned about these 32 marks. But this having been said, we don't know in like the Upanishads at that time, there's no mention of these 32 marks. So it's not really clear where it comes from. And I will say that there is also a sutta in which each mark is associated with some skillful thing that the Buddha did in a former life. So the Buddhists did kind of take this on and say that there's a reason why Buddha has these 32 marks, but I think this is something that there isn't a clear answer for. And I don't know, Ying, Kim, David, do you guys have some more to add?
I would just, I'm just sort of intrigued by your question, Wayne, part of your question that said, is it poetry? And I would just say, yeah, is it? Sort of question back to you or back to us. I do think because we're looking at this in a different way, you know, that it's that's a really interesting and legitimate question. Just how does it function in the oral presentation? You know, how does it land in our ears? And again, if we kind of try to analyze it, as Diana said, we can only go so far with what we know. But I like the idea that it falls as a way of, for me, it's had this sense of, it's about recognizing a great teacher when you're in that presence. And, you know, this might not occur to us, but I think we do have ways that we refer to that. It may be poetic that one of the things I used earlier this week was the idea that, and this isn't poetic, it's something that younger people than I say, but he's the real deal, you know, and maybe this is a way of sort of communicating that's what's being assessed here. So anyway, I really like that idea of yours that possibly there's poetry here if we attune our ears to it. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, maybe I'll just say that what struck for me was that there may be a sense of the broader popular culture still really just cares about the appearances in various ways. And maybe that's also a way of contrasting what the Buddha was teaching. And that just came to my mind. And I realized, you know, remembering the commentary speaking about Pokrasati, so much is about its appearances, you know, the color, the beauty of this Brahman, senior Brahman. So, Will.
Trying to get unmuted there. This also shows up in the earlier narratives, or at least, you know, about the Buddha's birth. You know, the person that comes up with the prophecy that he'll either be a wheel-turning monarch, or he'll be a great spiritual teacher. So that appears in that context as well.
Yes.
They don't specifically say the 32 marks, but those two possibilities.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. And James Allen.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that our team of teachers has had two strategies. One, to explain to us the sutra, point out to us the way in which the Buddha has done his pedagogy. And I'm interested whether that was a deliberate decision. One another, or to bring out.
Yeah, so James, you're cutting out a little bit. I feel like we're missing some important words that you were saying. I think you were asking whether it's a deliberate decision in terms of how we were teaching. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's the basic question.
Yes, I would say yes. For us, we were definitely experimenting this as a way of teaching and what the suttas were conveying. And maybe I'll just invite other co-teachers to say a few words, if you have any.
Yeah.
I could add that, you know, there is a question as to whether, you know, art should stand as its own and do you kill it by explaining it, something like that. But we felt like both approaches would be helpful with a teaching such as this that might be hard to understand some of the nuances of it, like the Brahmanical culture. So I think some of that is easier to explain outside in order to understand what's going on in the teaching. But I invite David, you had a comment.
I think Diana did as well, but I would just add too, I think I maybe heard a little bit more of the question. It did cut out, but I would just say that, you know, we're kind of revealing our pedagogy, but you know, which is fine, no secrets, but we also leave a lot of room for improvisation, and we have, you can't see it, but we, in various ways, we each are looking at a carefully script minute by minute, 3 minutes for this, 8 minutes for that. And as I look at some of my colleagues' notes and they talk about it, it's, they're, you know, they go off script. That is, they move away from their notes to kind of respond to what's come up already in the questions, for example, or the discussion or things we talked about or thought about overnight. So it's free in that way too. I just want to, I think it would be unfortunate if we gave the impression we have sort of a canned idea of what we're getting ourselves into when we start. We don't.
Maybe I'll add one thing that, you know, when you guys went into a breakout group, we went into our own breakout group and we were laughing and smiling like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we pulled that off, you know? So we're also having fun. So kind of in this new way of exploring and sharing the sutta in this way. So.
Yeah. So in this way, we're both the students and we're teaching at the same time. Yeah. So I saw there are lots of comments in the chat box. So thank you for sharing them. Very nourishing and just happy. So, yeah.
So just a couple notes before we sign off for today, maybe in preparation for Friday. We like to joke about assigning homework. We say homework with air quotes around it. But if you feel so moved, you might read this section that we've come through today. I believe, checking my notes here, that it's up to the end of section 4, or up to section 4 in the Sujata translation. But I'd be really interested to know, and maybe you're interested too, to see how it reads as text after we've gone through this more orally oriented reading of it. We commented in our breakout room just a few minutes ago how much more we see what's available in the text, how much more is offered in a way, how the teachings come through in different ways than we do when we just read it. We've read this many times. It's different to hear it, to say it, to speak it. So you might try speaking a little out loud. Read a character. Some of you here have read some of these characters. And I would just say too, sort of watch for the teachings to come bubbling up now, right? The whole purpose of this exploration is to bring us closer to the teachings and use this novel way of presenting them or exploring them as a way into them. So just look for that. The wise speech of the Buddha, or the gradual training, or our attachment to self. All of these things may start to be alive in us a little bit more now as a result of this exploration together. So anyway, take care till Friday. We look forward to seeing everyone again. Unmute and say goodbye for now if you feel moved to do so. And take care. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
See you on Friday.
Thank you.